This is the OANDA podcast, brought to you by Jazz FM's Business Breakfast.
Welcome back to the OANDA Market Insights podcast, brought to you with the Jazz FM Business Breakfast. I'm Johnny Hart. Of course, each week we review all the stories that made the business and market headlines. And it's time to say hello again to OANDA Senior Market Analyst Craig Earlham. How are you doing?
I'm very good, Johnny. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Not as dramatic a week as we've had. What was your market moment of the week?
Yeah, it was very quiet, to be quite honest. Quite a difficult one to really get too up for. I think the fact that we had this Italian political situation at least gave us something to get our teeth stuck into this week. And that is my market moment of the week. It's not a new story. We know that these discussions have been taking place in the background. And it's not as if we thought that this was a situation which couldn't happen. But it was the worst case scenario for the markets. And they were a bit slow to react to it at times. It seemed that they'd become a little numb to what exactly they were going to do. Were they going to tone it down and adopt something a little more market friendly, so not cut taxes quite as far as they were talking about in the campaign, and not ramping up spending as much? But it was the moment that really shook the markets, the one that sent 10-year Italian yields had to their highest in months, the thing that hit the FTSE MIB and knocked it by 2% and sent it on a bit of a downward spiral. And that was the leak of the programme which the two parties had drawn up. I believe it was leaked by Huffington Post in Italy. And this really concerned people. Now, I should stress that both parties have said that a number of things that are in there are not in the final draft copy. There were things in there which are concerning, and they almost were at the root of people's fears. Was laid out on paper. So it was saying that it's going to push for the ECB to write off 250 billion euros of Italian debt, which would equate to around 10% of GDP. That's just not going to happen. And the fact that that is something they'd push for gives you a great insight into both what their priorities are and how they deal with their problems. There was the fact that they wanted to go to back to pre the Maastricht Treaty, in other words, the talking about budget deficits being kept below 3% and public debt below 60% of GDP. So it suggests that there is this fiscal credibility which investors need to have in countries if they're going to continue to buy their bonds. This isn't as important to these parties, which suggests these big spending plans which they were talking about in the election could potentially be followed out. And there was other components of this leaked document as well which were concerning, one of which I think was, and probably the most concerning given the history of both of them, was this idea that they wanted to put something in place so that if a country wanted to leave the Eurozone project, that it could follow these steps in order to do so. The EU for the Eurozone for a long time has said the euro is irreversible, and the reason why Brexit is so difficult, and I imagine leaving the Eurozone is even more difficult again, is to discourage countries from doing so and make the price to pay for doing so very, very hefty. So the fact that you've got these two parties looking to create an easier route out doesn't bode well. Five Star Movement have previously called for a referendum on Eurozone membership. They did drop it as part of this campaign, I think, personally, in order to overcome people's fears and get them into power, which has worked. Liga are still pushing for an exit. So this is not the type of thing that investors want to hear.
It's quite a wish list, isn't it? Those elements in that document. And we're seeing so much more of this when it comes to these populist parties. We've seen it with Donald Trump in America, and some would say it's the same thing with Jeremy Corbyn over here. It's almost as if you're presenting unlikely events and unlikely deals to the electorate, and they actually buy it.
Yeah, I mean, I think these parties want to do what they're saying, but it's almost like you say, it's almost kind of like a bribe. If you offer people enough good things, then they will vote for you. Does that mean that you should and will carry it out? No. Does that mean that it's responsible?
Or you're even able to carry these things out? I mean, most of these things that you've just listed would be impossible.
Exactly. Even if they somehow find a way to carry some of them out, is it responsible? Well, it's probably not responsible. Who's actually going to pay the price for it? Well, you're just passing the problem on, passing the burden on to future generations. And the argument for it is always the same. It will pay for itself in higher growth. Where have we heard that before? That's what Donald Trump has said. That's how he's going to pay for his tax cuts.
Jeremy Corbyn has said about various aspects, nationalisation, paying off all the student loans, There's a long list there as well, isn't there?
And it's a huge risk, because what if it doesn't pay for itself in growth? Then what then? You've got this a huge amount of debt. Well, I mean, then that's where you go for QE, right? That's where you go for people's QE, as it's been called, where you just get the central bank to print more money to fill that debt gap. Well, that sounds like a fantastic idea. If only we could do this money printing exercise all the time. Well, unfortunately, in the real world, a real world problem has to be solved with a real world solution. And the thing that concerns people with this Italian situation, one is the exit, but the other one is that debt is already, I think, above 130% of GDP. They already have a huge debt problem. This would just add to this. At what point do people lose faith in their ability to repay that debt? They don't have their own central bank, so they can't just cut interest rates, or they can't just find ways to get the central banks, say, buying up Italian bonds and restoring confidence in the market. The ECB only stepped in when the whole Eurozone economy was significantly under threat. They wouldn't just do that to help Italy out because they've decided to run a massive budget deficit. So there are genuine concerns here, because if they want to do all of that and Liga want to cut, make a flat tax rate of 15% or around 15 to 20%, and Five Star Movement want to create a minimum wage, a minimum payment for poorer people, which again has to be funded one way or another. They want to undo some of Mario Monti and his technocratic government's policies, such as when he raised the retirement age. They want to reverse that. If they want to do all these things, these do cost money. And unfortunately, Italy just doesn't have it.
Okay, let's move on to the United Kingdom. And more specifically, one of the Bank of England deputy governors, Mr. Ben Broadbent, got into a bit of trouble this week, saying that the UK economy is entering a menopausal phase, claiming we're heading for a downturn. All the headlines are about this one word of menopausal, weren't they, rather than the actual data itself.
I don't think the explanation really helped his cause either. He said menopausal, and then he backed it up by saying it's past its peak and less potent. I mean, how much deeper can one dig themselves? It's quite astonishing that someone in such a position found that an appropriate term to use. I mean, I think anyone with common sense would have seen that and thought, oh no, you may want to steer clear of that. He's got himself into a little spot of bother. And I mean, I've seen people being forced to resign for less, to be quite honest. Whether he will, we'll have
sloppy,
to wait and see.
It was sloppy, wasn't it? There was no malice aforethought there, was there?
No, but it is extremely sloppy. And it's almost sloppy, but it also comes across as incredibly insensitive.
Do you think it was offensive?
I think a lot of people will find that extremely offensive, especially given the explanation that followed. Mm. It put such a negative spin on it. And I think, it's extremely sloppy, but it doesn't, for it, considering you look at the Bank of England, for example, when the policymakers lined up for the inflation report, for the press conference, and you look at it, and at a time when we're trying to talk about gender equality, equal pay, blah, and all of this, big serious issues that we do have in this country, and then you see the Bank of England lining up for this press conference, and I know they're not an all-male committee, but I sat on this table, if I'm not mistaken, was four old white men. It doesn't help.
One of the deputy governors, a female, had to leave her job last year.
Yes, she did.
And she's actually been speaking about that over the last couple of days, which is an interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the story you're referring to was because she didn't disclose that she had a relative, a brother, I think it was, working at one of the major banks, and therefore she was forced to leave her role. She was talking about the lessons that had been learned from that. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't work going on within the Bank of England and others to try and make create a workforce that is more equal and equally paid as well, and that is extremely important. But at a time when that is clearly not the case, I think you've just got to be far more sensible and really choose your words more wisely. And as I say, quite astonishing.
Let's actually concentrate on the data itself, though. That the UK jobs data was interesting.
It was, because, I mean, it was mostly in line with expectations. The unemployment was 4.2%. We saw decent wage growth, but what the wage growth figures told us, and it depends on what level of inflation you use, because we have to remember the Bank of England now has its own preferred measure of inflation. I think it's CPIH, and I think that takes into consideration rents as part of people's expenditure and the link to inflation. And what the data effectively showed was that wage growth minus that level of inflation is now at 0%. So we've exited a period of real wages actually falling and entered one where they are just not growing. Still not great figures, shows a slight improvement. It does suggest that the labour market itself is quite good. Obviously 4.2% unemployment, record employment, record highest levels of males and females aged 16 to 64 in employment. There were some very impressive figures here, but I think the wage issue is a longer term issue, because we know that this country has a problem with productivity, which unfortunately is what Mr. Broadbent was referring to. And without productivity, it's hard to see real wages rising on a consistent basis. And I know the Bank of England has faith that the fact that we are seeing wages growing at around 2.7% now, and it is rising, that therefore this is a sign that it's a tight labour market. I'm still not completely convinced. I think what we're seeing right now with wages is a reflection of that jump in the cost of living as a result of the depreciation of the pound. And this is almost that second stage effect now, because the cost of living rose by so much, people demanded more money. If the cost of living doesn't jump again by the same amount next year, are people going to be pushing for higher raises, or are companies going to be as willing to offer them? I don't think they will. So I think you are going to see a slowdown. There was also the fact that the wage growth figures were made to look a little better by the fact that there was a slump like this time last year. So the year-on-year comparison actually looks a lot better than it is, and that it's likely to be.
We'll talk about oil in a minute. Before we do, I wanted to ask you whether you had an opinion about this new rule regarding fixed odds in bookmakers. It's now, of course, the maximum stakes now £2. This was actually a bit of a surprise. I was expecting a compromise.
You can't always rely on politicians to make a decision which is entirely moral and doesn't take taxes into consideration, because what the government stands to lose as a result of taxes now is quite significant because of the money which they do make from these bookmakers. So the fact that they actually took the minimum of these stakes is quite considerable. Dropping from £100 to £2 is enormous. I think around 50% of William Hill's profits come from these fixed odds betting terminals. Their revenues come from these fixed odds betting terminals. So this is a huge decision. A number of stores could close, a large number of jobs could be lost, and you can understand the argument from the other side of this as well. People saying, well, you can't, this alone won't stop people gambling, because it's still unlimited bet sizes that you can make online. So what you're going to do is you're going to push people out the shops, you're going to cause all these job losses, and then people will just go online and do it anyway. Personally, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think people are going to go online. I think people go into the betting shops because they enjoy that atmosphere, they enjoy that experience. And I say enjoy, and I use that word very, very lightly, because I do think the addictive element is extremely serious. There's definitely going to be cases where people are losing far more than they have. That's the problem with having with where these shops are and what they're near, because these shops are not typically, especially in mass numbers, in affluent areas. They are around people who are less well off,
most
and
vulnerable,
are more likely to want to use them because they're hoping for that one big payday. Well, unfortunately, what else is in those areas is typically payday loans companies, and you wonder how many of these people have got themselves into a lot of financial difficulty and turned to a payday loan lender and gone straight back to the betting shop.
And bookies' share prices took a bit of a hit, didn't they?
They did take a bit of a hit, but interestingly rebounded the very same day. So they took quite a considerable hit. I think they were about 9% or something, and then they sprung back. I think there's two reasons for this. One, this isn't a new story. This is something which has been discussed for the last year.
Although we didn't expect the £2.
We didn't, but for the last, I'd say, couple of weeks, there has been a growing amount of speculation that this was happening, and the share price responded to that speculation. The other is that the timing of this US ruling has been very, very good, particularly for someone like William Hill, who was going to be among the hardest hit by the £2 ruling. But the fact that they can now venture more into the US, and William Hill already has a very strong presence in the likes of Las Vegas. The fact that they can now venture into the US, into the sports gambling industry, that's an enormous potential market. So that can hopefully fill the void, but that doesn't do much for UK jobs.
Okay, before we talk about next week, a brief word about oil then. Hit around $80 a barrel, and there are quite a few reasons for this. Of course, this time last week we were discussing the end of the Iran nuclear deal, or we're not sure yet, but it looks like certainly the Americans are going to go out, and that's had an effect on the price of oil, as have another a number of other factors as well.
There's so much influencing the price of oil right now. The Iran deal is obviously one. The production cut between OPEC and non-OPEC members, I think it's around 28 producers in total, is still having an impact. They've still cut in oil production by 1.8 million barrels a day. The situation in Venezuela, we are seeing Venezuela pumping less oil, and it's continuing to decrease because of the terrible situation in the country, and they are another major oil producer.
Haven't the Saudis promised to actually put more supply into the system?
They have said that they will be willing and able to do so if necessary. Whether they will be quick to do so is another matter indeed, because again, we have the Saudi Aramco IPO, which has been long talked about and is near. I'm not sure of the exact date for that, or even one, if one has been laid out, but if you are going to list 5% of the shares of the country's major oil producer, the one thing you really need when you're making that IPO is a high cost of oil, because that ultimately affects the bottom line. So if oil's trading at $30 to $40 a barrel or $80 a barrel, what's the higher IPO price going to be? That has to be on Saudi Arabia's mind, and that has to be playing into this decision to cut production by 1.8 million barrels a day. There's other factors playing a part as well. There's global oil demand. There's the strength of the dollar, which has risen considerably over the past month, which typically has an inverse relationship with commodity prices, because typically if I have pounds and oil is priced in dollars, if the dollar becomes stronger against the pound, it costs more of my pounds to buy those dollars to buy that oil. So what a rising dollar does is it makes oil more expensive for non-dollar consumers, and that typically affects demand. So there's a number of factors at play, I guess, is what I'm trying to say right now. I'm interested to see how it's going to respond above $80 a barrel, because I don't think there's enormous appetite amongst certain countries like Russia to let it go too much further. I think they would much rather ramp up production at this point. The US shale industry is going to be quick to respond to this, to oil at these prices. So it will be interesting to see how much of an increase we see from the US as well. And there was also the report, I think it was from OPEC, and it effectively showed that within 90 days, they could ramp up production by, I think it was either 3.5 or 4.5 million barrels a day. So they certainly have the capacity to increase oil output. The question is whether they'll have the desire to.
Okay, finally, what are you looking forward to next week? Is it going to be a fairly quiet one?
It's going to be a relatively quiet one, but there are some highlights. So, for example, we have some data out on Wednesday, some PMI surveys, UK inflation. We've got UK retail sales on Thursday, ECB minutes on Thursday, I believe, as well. UK GDP on Friday alongside some PCUS data. So it's not going to be overly quiet. And I believe we may also have the UK inflation report hearing on Tuesday. And that's where Mark Carney will appear before the Treasury Select Committee. And we all know how those duels typically go. He'll be alongside some of his colleagues from the MPC there. I'll be interested to see if Ben Broadbent will be making an appearance at this particular thing, and whether these comments will come up, because they do like to get quite political in these things. And the thing that people most look forward to in these situations is always the Carney Rees-Mogg battle. And these have been going on for a lot much longer than Brexit has been a thing. And if anything, this was what helped him rise to fame, was his battles with Mark Carney, one pro-Brexiteer versus a central banker who was warning about the downsides of it.
Craig, thanks very much for joining us today. We look forward to this time next week.
Thank you.
That's Craig Earlham, Senior Market Analyst at Oanda. Don't forget, you can hear this podcast on Android and via iTunes. See you next time.
was the O'Ander podcast from the team behind Jazz FM's Business Breakfast, a daily early morning 30-minute briefing for the day ahead. On air from 6 a.m. Listen to Jazz FM on DAB, online, or just ask Alexa.